Napoleon Hill often worked late into the night. The house would fall quiet. The world outside would dissolve into shadows. But Hill was never alone. He would sit at his desk with his pen in his hand, his eyes sometimes closed, sometimes fixed on the page as if listening for a voice just beyond hearing. Before he wrote, he would pause. Before he decided, he would consult, not necessarily with living men, but with an unseen assembly that he trusted more than his own doubts. In his imagination, or perhaps somewhere deeper, Andrew Carnegie sat across from him. He was steady and exacting. Thomas Edison leaned forward with restless intensity. Lincoln stood quietly, saying very little, but weighing everything. Emerson spoke in symbols. Darwin asked questions that dismantled certainty. Jesus embodied compassion without weakness, and Napoleon Bonaparte radiated command and consequence. Napoleon Hill would ask them questions, and he would wait, and then he would write. This was not a literary trick. This was his invisible counsel, and for decades, he barely spoke about it. Napoleon Hill is best known for Think and Grow Rich, one of the most influential self-development books that has ever been written. Commissioned by Andrew Carnegie himself, Hill spent over 20 years interviewing the most powerful, successful minds of his era, distilling what he believed were universal principles of achievement. What most people didn't know, what was largely absent from early editions, from his lectures and public explanations, was that Hill believed the greatest guidance that he received, it didn't come from interviews at all. It came from an inner practice he developed after years of study, after years of contemplation, and years of failure. Now, Napoleon Hill didn't always succeed. He lost fortunes. He was humiliated publicly. He faced long stretches of obscurity and even despair. It was during these periods that he later admitted that he began assembling his invisible council. He describes this practice most clearly in Think and Grow Rich, in a chapter that many readers sometimes skim or they dismiss as only imagination. This is the chapter on the sixth sense. Yet in later writings and later lectures, he reveals that his invisible counselors, they weren't only a group of living collaborators. It was also an internalized council of archetypal intelligences. He claimed that at first he simply imagined conversations, but over time, something changed. The responses surprised him. The insights exceeded his conscious reasoning. The council began to feel autonomous. Whether someone understands this psychologically, spiritually, or symbolically, he insisted on one thing. The guidance actually worked. So what is the invisible council really? The invisible council, they're not spirit guides in the traditional religious sense, nor is it just simple positive thinking. It's an intentional relationship with internalized wisdom built through reverence, focus, and repeated consultation. From a psychological perspective, Hill was externalizing internal archetypes, much like Carl Jung would later describe the figures of the collective unconscious. Jung wrote that when archetypal images are engaged consciously, they become sources of guidance rather than unconscious forces that control us. And Napoleon Hill, he was doing precisely this before Jung's work was widely known in America. From a spiritual perspective, he believed consciousness itself was participatory. He believed thought was not merely private, but connected to a universal intelligence. In his words, the brain of man may be compared to an electric battery, capable of being charged and discharged. He didn't believe he was inventing any type of wisdom. He believed he was tuning into it. Importantly, the council wasn't some sort of fantasy escape. He emphasized discipline in his book. He approached his council with seriousness, respect, and ethical intention. He didn't ask how to dominate other people. He asked how to think rightly, act decisively, and persist through bouts of fear. So why was this hidden or minimized for so long? there's a persistent claim that the Invisible Council was intentionally downplayed or removed from earlier editions of his work. But the truth is a little bit more nuanced here. Early publishers were cautious. The early 20th century was a time when anything resembling mysticism, it risked being dismissed as delusion. He was already pretty controversial. Including explicit descriptions of inner councils, it risked undermining the credibility of his entire philosophy. He himself admitted that he feared ridicule. He wanted his work to reach businessmen, educators, and practical thinkers, and he knew that if he led with unseen advisors, many people would just stop listening. So the practice was encoded, and the language that he used was a little bit safer. Collaboration, collective intelligence, and shared purpose, if used in a different language, could be discussed publicly, and the inner dimension remained partly veiled. So what was his experience with his invisible council? In his book, he describes moments when he felt guided away from disastrous decisions, when he was guided towards opportunities that he himself couldn't logically justify at the time. He claimed that during major writing blocks, answers would arrive fully formed. During periods of fear, he felt steadied by a presence that reminded him of his long-term vision. He also insisted that his own counsel challenged him. So this wasn't necessarily an echo chamber. The imagined figures, they disagreed with him, they questioned his motives, they exposed rationalizations. And this is crucial. Any practice that only confirms what you already want is not wisdom. It's just simply indulgence. So his counsel, it functioned as this internal court of ethics, this court of intelligence and perspective. I want to read you a very short excerpt of this chapter because I think you all will find this quite amusing. So it reads as follows. These meetings became so realistic that I became fearful of their consequences and discontinued them for several months. The experiences were so uncanny, I was afraid if I continued them, I would lose sight of the fact that the meetings were purely experiences of my imagination. Some 6 months later, after I had discontinued the practice, I was awakened one night, or thought I was, when I saw Lincoln standing at my bedside, and he said, "The world will soon need your services. It's about to undergo a period of chaos, which will cause men and women to lose faith and become panic-stricken. Go ahead with your work and complete your philosophy. That is your mission in life. If you neglect it for any cause whatsoever, you will be reduced to a primal state and be compelled to retrace the cycles through which you have passed during thousands of years." And so he says, "I was unable to tell the following morning whether I had dreamed this or had actually been awake, and I have never since found out which it was. But I do know that the dream, if it were a dream, was so vivid in my mind the next day that I resumed my meetings the following night. At our next meeting, the members of my cabinet all filed into the room together and stood at their accustomed places at the council table, while Lincoln raised a glass and said, 'Gentlemen, let us drink a toast to a friend who has returned to the fold.'" So why does the invisible council matter today? Modern life, it isolates decision-making. We're expected to choose things pretty quickly, publicly, and even alone. We confuse independence with wisdom and even speed with clarity. The invisible council reintroduces deliberation. It reintroduces humility and even perspective. It teaches that intelligence is not merely personal, it's relational, even internally. It suggests that the mind becomes more capable when it learns to consult rather than react. And in this age of so much noise and distraction, the invisible council restores very meaningful and deep dialogue. But it also reframes intuition. Rather than treating intuition as impulse or even emotion, Napoleon Hill's practice trains intuition through structure. You are the one who chooses the values that you consult. You choose the standards of thought that you internalize. Essentially, you become who you listen to. So how do we create our own invisible council? You know, what's really interesting in this book, after the passage that I read to you about Lincoln, like welcoming Napoleon Hill back after his, 6-month hiatus, he decides to begin to add a bunch of new members to his cabinet, right? So the list starts off kind of small. But it's funny, he expands it to more than 50 members. So, of course, he has Christ, he has St. Paul, Galileo, Copernicus, Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, Homer, Voltaire. He has Newton, Confucius, and many, many more. So in his book, he emphasizes that the council, it has to be chosen quite deliberately. And of course, looking at his own personal council or cabinet, I mean, he has very wise people. He says to avoid, of course, choosing anybody that you idolize. No heroes, right, for their fame alone, but really important figures, whether these are historical, symbolic, or spiritual, who embody the qualities that you wish to cultivate. The council works because the psyche learns through relationship. When you repeatedly ask, what would wisdom say here? The mind reorganizes itself around higher order thinking, and over time, this becomes instinct. Now, importantly, he warns that the council reflects the integrity of the person who assembles it. If your values are shallow, your guidance is going to be shallow too. If your intentions are ethical and disciplined, the council becomes refining rather than flattering. This isn't just manifestation magic. It's moral imagination that's trained towards a specific purpose. So at its core, the Invisible Council teaches that consciousness, again, is participatory. I think this is something that I've talked about a few times so far this year. It teaches that we're not meant to stumble blindly through life reacting to all these different circumstances. It teaches that the human mind, when it's trained, it becomes a meeting place between effort and insight. Now, Napoleon Hill believed success was not just the accumulation of wealth alone. It was the alignment of thought, desire, and action with a larger intelligence. Whether we name that intelligence God, universal mind, or the depths of the psyche is essentially secondary. What matters here is the relationship and that you are never thinking alone. So, Napoleon Hill didn't invent the Invisible Council. He remembered it. Philosophers, they've always consulted some form of inner assembly. Plato himself, he wrote dialogues not as these mere abstractions, but as conversations with living ideas. And the Stoics, they practiced this nightly self-examination as if they were answering to some sort of inner tribunal. Mystics across traditions, they describe councils, courts, and assemblies of wisdom within themselves. So Napoleon Hill, he gave modern language to an ancient practice. And the question isn't whether that this council exists. The question is who you have already given a seat to at the table of your mind. Every decision that you make is already a consultation. And the Invisible Council, it simply asks you to choose your advisors wisely. Everybody, thank you for listening and tuning in to today's episode. Of course, if you're interested in this book, you can find it anywhere and probably at a used bookstore. Everyone, please have a great week ahead. Take care of yourselves, and I look forward to connecting with you next week. Bye-bye.